The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly, a special on the relationship between football and climate change, the sport's impact on our climate and the changing climate's impact on the game. One fascinating thing about this subject is that it is barely talked about. But there is a climate emergency in the world, and football happens to take place in the world. Questions then, from private jets to football teams, to fans travelling the world to follow them, from new kits being designed and made every season to the suspect climate-friendly credentials of the game's biggest sponsors. And how much should fans care? And how do you make them care? Football's meant to be an escape from the existential worries about the future, or more accurately, football's meant to cause existential crises that don't really matter rather than ones that do. We'll discuss all of it with an expert panel, one of those pods where Barry and I don't say much and then you all hopefully say it was great. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Barry, how are you? Nice to see you.
I'm very well, thanks, Max. I'm actually looking forward to this because I didn't realise until about 3 hours ago just how breathtakingly ignorant and unaware I was of the imminent apocalypse and B, the size of football's carbon footprint. So, I'm looking forward to hearing what we can do. And I think there are probably already people, they will see this being released, they will see it on Twitter, and they will roll their eyes and go, oh, here we go, it's the Guardian being, you know, happy-clappy. But, I think this is going to be very good.
Great. On the panel today, then, David Goldblatt, author of The Age of Football, The Global Game in the 21st Century, and who published Playing Against the Clock, Global Sport and Climate Change last June. Thanks for coming on, David.
Pleasure. Great to be here.
And thanks for pestering me occasionally about why we should be doing this podcast. Ollie Hayes, host of Sustainababble podcast, and probably the first time ever there have been two Cambridge United fans on the Guardian Football Weekly at the same time. Ollie, how are you doing?
Very good. Very good after this weekend, thank you as well. Fen Army.
Yes. Yeah, I didn't want to bring that up quite so soon, as the final member of the panel is the chairman of Forest Green Rovers, who we hammered 1-0 on Saturday, Dale Vince. Thanks so much for coming on, Dale.
Yeah, pleasure, actually. And I thought the best team won on Saturday, so I've got no bad feelings about that.
It's very kind of you to say. Forest Green Rovers, of course, recognised by FIFA and the UN as the world's greenest club. We've had loads of questions. Thank you for all the questions, which were a bit like Ollie Burns. Given St James's Park is at the top of a hill, will Newcastle have a chance of winning the league if the polar ice caps melt and flood the country? We'll maybe get to those if we have time. In part one, we're going to look at climate crisis's impact on football and football's impact on the climate crisis. And there was a first question from Peter, which said, what does football have to do with climate change? It's quite an open question that could probably take an hour. David?
Well, it goes in two directions. On the one hand, football and commercial sport in general is a significant contributor to the world's carbon emissions. And on the other hand, football, just like absolutely everything else on this planet, every institution, every social practice, is going to be affected by climate change in the next 30 years. So just to give you like the back of the fag packet calculation, the global sports industry is worth something in the region of $500 billion, and that's not including illegal betting or sportswear. So that makes it about 0.8% of global GDP. On the one hand, it's not like manufacturing cement, so it's not as carbon intensive as some things. On the other hand, it's much carbon lighter than other kinds of economic practice, and I reckon it's probably around the middle, mainly because of transportation. So that means, you know, global sport as a whole, 0.8% of global carbon emissions. Not a lot, you might think, but that's like Poland or Spain, and no one's giving them a pass on dealing with this problem. And then football within that, you know, I reckon it's around 0.3, 0.4%, you know, as the most popular global game with the biggest number of spectators globally. I'm going to say it's 0.3, 0.4%, but that's like, you know, Tunisia. It's not an insignificant amount in and of itself. So that's the impact football and sport's making. Other way around, in terms of how climate change is going to impact on football, well, it depends where you live. Let's start. If you're living in Ghana, daytime football and a kickabout outside the house at noon in 2045 is not going to be a pleasant experience. I mean, all over the world, outdoor football with rising temperatures. And the physiology of this stuff is like once you get over 35 degrees centigrade, everything is going south. And there's going to be a lot more than 35 degrees centigrade in this world. Then you're looking at the issue of drought. And again, that's not going to be a problem probably in Lancashire, but it's going to be a really significant issue on grass pitches all over the world. I mean, we've had this problem in cricket in India and South Africa recently. And then you've got the humidity, because heat is bad, but heat plus humidity, which is what we expect with more extreme weather in the future, is really problematic. And that's why this summer, the Tokyo Olympic Marathon is not being run in Tokyo, because it's too dangerous, because it's too hot and it's too humid. And they're going to run it in Sapporo, 1,000 kilometres north. Here in Britain, the big issue is going to be extreme weather and rain, of course. It's not going to be sunshine. Our problem is going to be rain. I think we're looking at a lot more cancellations, a lot more. We've had those in the last few years due to extreme weather. Grassroots football is in serious trouble. We're already in a situation where around a third of grassroots pitches are losing 6 weeks to 2 months of the year from flooding and inadequate drainage. And there is a lot of that coming our way. And then just to top it all off, we've got the problem of sea level rising and flooding from, again, extreme weather events. And I did a bit of research on a website called climatecentral.org. And it's Google Maps plus climate and sea level rise predictions. And I put in the addresses of the 92 stadiums of the top four leagues and asked, what's this going to look like in 2050? Now, there are some caveats because the degree to which mitigation, building of seawalls, etc. is taken into account is not clear. But even so, 23 of the 92 are going to be looking at annual problems of serious flooding by 2050. That's not very far away. I mean, you know, the Riverside in Middlesbrough will probably be okay, but Steve Gibson's going to have to buy a fleet of gondoliers to get people to the stadium, the way the sea level rises on the coast of Teesside are looking. And, you know, Grimsby Town, bless them, I love them. I think they may have to take up water polo, the way things are looking at the moment. And I joke, but this is a serious matter. And, of course, it's not just here. You know, Bordeaux's Atletic Stadium, Werder Bremen Stadium, all very close to the sea, all deeply imperiled by sea level rises. So, you know, across the board, depending on where you are, a whole series of problems going to be placing professional and amateur football. And, you know, we're not the global cement industry here, but it's a significant contribution.
Dale, does it surprise you, given the extent of the issues? If you try and Google it, there's almost nothing written about it. You know, in fact, probably everything is written about Forest Green Rovers, you know.
Yeah, it kind of doesn't surprise me really, I suppose, because, you know, we got started doing this about 10 years ago, creating a green football club. It just came about from rescuing Forest Green, our local club. Never had a plan or anything like that. And then I guess quickly realised just how radical it was to try to bring the environment and sustainability into football. And then a few years ago, we hooked up with the UN and we're founding signatories of the Sport for Climate Action programme, which is kind of a programme to engage the whole world of sport in the stuff that Forest Green have done. And so I guess from where I'm sat, there's quite a lot going on. I think we've got over 200 signatories to the programme now and the UN are right behind it and stuff's happening. But you're probably right, you know, in terms of general media coverage, you'll see stuff about Forest Green and what we've done, but there's not a lot more. I think that's fair.
I love the idea of just hooking up with the UN. You're a more connected man than I am. Ollie, what are your like initial thoughts just hearing what David says?
Yeah, well, I think everything David said is... well, it's scary and it's big, isn't it? Like that's the thing about climate change in general. It's so massive and overwhelming that no one knows where to start talking about it. And, you know, it's even when you look at it in the context of one industry like football, again, it's just like, well, what where do we start? What can we do? But I think talking about it is probably one of the most important things that needs to happen. And there's been this kind of almost like a sort of climate, a culture of silence around climate change. It is a bit taboo. It is one of those things that you don't really want to bring up with your mates because you'll be the weirdo or they'll think something differently or whatever. But it's the story of our time. It's going to become even more the story of our time. And, you know, David was talking about what was going to happen to grounds in 2050. And that's, you know, 2050 is closer than 1990 was. Well, to us, you know, it feels like a long way away, but it's not a long way away. And of course, the impacts are happening now already. So I just think it's really important to talk about it as a starting point, and to acknowledge that it's massive and it's difficult and it's complicated and it's going to be uncomfortable. But that's, you know, we've got to start somewhere.
Historically, David, football is quite slow to change as well.
Well, you know, yes and no. I mean, who knew about, you know, false number nines a few years back? Then you can't move for them. They're everywhere. I mean, actually, the rapidity with which technical, tactical, statistical knowledge moves around the global football world is probably faster than it's ever been. There are no invisible, like, you know, we used to watch the World Cup and it's like, oh, Brazil, I haven't seen that for 4 years. Now everybody in football actually knows everything all the time. So I think the possibility actually of rapid change is not inconceivable. And you've got a very different kind of caliber and group of people running football clubs these days. And we're talking, you know, pretty serious operators. So I think the technical ability is there to do it. And I think, as Dale said, there is real momentum. I mean, you know, when you have four now members of the Premier League have signed up to the UN Sport for Climate Action framework, when you're beginning to hear players like Hector Bellerin or Patrick Bamford are beginning to talk in some way about climate action. And I just feel it, you know, more broadly in society. People are kind of post-COVID, I think, people are beginning to wake up a little bit to this stuff. I mean, this is how I came to be writing about it myself, you know, made it my kind of lockdown project, was what's the lesson of COVID, you know? Well, take the scientists seriously, assume the worst case scenario really can happen. And if you're going to do something about it, let's do it now, not 10 years down the line. And I thought, well, let's apply that to climate change and sport. And there's, you know, huge things bubbling under. Arsenal have got their kind of extraordinary lithium battery, you know, and a stadium covered in solar panels. And it's not just in football, you know, Gloucester County Cricket Club is committed to being carbon zero as well. There's definitely movement out there. And, you know, cynicism is easy. I've been doing that one for 30 years on climate change. I mean, seriously, I wrote a PhD on this damn subject in the 1990s. And what was my conclusion? It's too hard. I don't know what to do. And actually, that didn't get me anywhere either for the last 30 years. So, you know, pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will, football and climate change.
But David, football's governing bodies don't seem to be paying much more than lip service to this. You know, tournaments are expanding. There are new tournaments. You know, there's going to be another European competition. This will all surely increase the carbon footprint rather than decrease it.
Sure. So something really helpful, I think, for all of us to think about, everyone to think about this, because people are always coming back to flying international tournaments, and of course they are a problem. But approximately 60 to 70% of the carbon footprint of any football club are spectators going to and from the stadium. We're the problem, not the team. I mean, of course, when we go to international matches, that redoubles the problem. But actually, you know, flying players around is for, let's take Wolfsburg, who have probably the most serious study of their carbon footprint of any football club I've seen. And, you know, flying the team around, moving them around, 2.5% of their carbon footprint. So that's just really worth bearing in mind, like where the big changes are going to have to come. 17, 18% of carbon emissions, energy, you know, for heating, lighting, you know, sorting out the pitch, all of that stuff. You know, sportswear and merchandising, 3 or 4%. Food, 2 or 3%, something like that. So the real bulk is in spectator travel. Okay, all of that said, your governing bodies, UEFA are making serious change here. I'm hearing good news from UEFA. Now, on the one hand, as you rightly say, Euro 2020, 12 stadiums all over the continent, millions of air miles, madness. On the other hand, UEFA are committed to offsetting the carbon emissions from Euro 2020 and all subsequent European championships by investing in reforestation, carbon capture, etc. And not just, you know, for their own costs, but every single spectator. So that's quite a commitment. I mean, we can argue whether offsets are a good thing or not. But I think at UEFA, yeah, you're beginning to hear change. And I should say, paradoxically, Qatar 2022, the most hydrocarbon-drenched tournament in all of human history, is also paradoxically committed to the most carbon-zero approach to actually running a tournament that we've seen so far. So there are laggards. Every league, every football association, every commercial football club needs to be signing up. And as Dale said, there are 200 signatories now at the UN. I mean, we need thousands and we need them now. It's like, not next week, the time to act is now.
Ollie?
Yeah, on the offsetting thing, like, I mean, I hate to be the doom monger, but it is The Guardian, surely I'm allowed, but it's...
Absolutely, yeah.
There's a massive question mark over offsetting. Not... There's obviously good schemes and there's bad schemes and everything in between, but it more often than not is used as a massive smokescreen for just continuing what you were doing already. And a lot of people don't use it like that, but a lot of people do use it like that. And it, you know, it's a difficult one to rely on. But I did want to just go on to that UN framework thing, which we've talked about before. It's great and it's really good to see those four Premier League clubs sign up to it. But I think there is a kind of elephant in the room with all of this, because I was having a look at it earlier, and number 4.4 of that framework is promote sustainable and responsible consumption. And I think when you start thinking about that in the context of the sponsorship of the game, that's when you start to run into problems, because you've got, you know, just look at the Champions League, you've got Gazprom all over it, Continental, Castrol, Emirates, Qatar Airways, you know, all of these high carbon industries, often very extractive industries that we see all over the game. And I think that you've got to seriously look at that as a club, as a ruling body, if you're going to be credible about that fourth bit of the UN framework that you're signed up to.
Dale, what do you think about that as a club? Do you look at your sponsors and... It's financially difficult for clubs, right?
Yeah, no, it's an easy issue for us. We bumped into it before. We won't take sponsorship from betting companies. We came out, I think, last week supporting a call to ban junk food from sports sponsorship, because they use sport for sport washing of what it is that they do. So we don't have any problems with that. We're simply against the things that we think are wrong and won't take money from those industries. I also just wanted to say, if I could, Ollie and David both mentioned that climate change looks difficult and complicated and you don't know where to start. We do see it differently to that. I think it's all about energy, transport and food. It's just three things: how you power yourself, how you travel and what you eat. And 80% of everybody's personal carbon footprint, more or less, and every organization, is just in those three things where we make decisions. And that's the kind of universal slide rule that we applied to Forest Green Rovers 10 years ago and to everything else that we do. It's really not that complicated. I just want to say that. And also Wolfsburg, they may have the most complete carbon accounting David's ever seen, but he hasn't looked at ours.
Well, look, we'll talk about yours in part two, and we'll do that in just a second.
Dale, you said there, I commend your fussiness over who you have as sponsors, but not every club is in a position to be as picky as Forest Green is. And that is something fans of other clubs will immediately leap on. So I think it would be negligent if I didn't raise it with you.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is we can't all afford to have morals and principles. And I think, you know, that's a terrible outlook on life, because we can all afford to have morals and principles. And I don't know if you remember, you probably do, back in the day, was it 20 years ago, there was a proposed ban on tobacco advertising for Formula One. And there was a big hoo-ha, it was going to kill the sport. What were these guys going to do for alternate revenue? And look at Formula One now, it's thriving without tobacco sponsorship. So football could thrive without betting sponsorship and without fast food sponsorship. It could happen. What we need is just a change in the rules, really, so that it applies to everybody and it's not a choice that people have to make.
Okay, that's a good place to end part one. Part two, I want to hear about your journey, Dale, with Forest Green, and find out how many other clubs look at you and are going to follow. We'll do that in a second. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly, climate change special, climate crisis special. We got an email from one of the bosses at the Guardian saying climate change is not the word anymore. It's not serious enough. It has to be climate crisis. Dale, when you got involved with Forest Green, you know, your local club, they're on the verge of bankruptcy. You transformed them into the world's first vegan and carbon neutral team, playing on an organic pitch. I don't even know what that is. With a kit now made of recycled coffee beans. What's that journey been like? And how easy or difficult was it to sort of carry fans, managers, players with you?
First, a question. How long do you think it would be before we escalate the language to climate clusterfuck?
Oh, well, we can do it from now.
I think, you know, the journey's been fun, and I would say it's been relatively easy, but it is, I think, because I have a particular mindset and approach, you know. So from the day that I first bumped into the fact that we had real issues at Forest Green, having rescued it, that we were serving red meat and I was part of the meat trade and I had to stop that. From that day, we just started making changes, and there was no way we would not make those changes. And I'm a sci-fi fan. I don't know if you guys watch Star Trek, but there's a particular alien species there called the Borg, and they have a great expression. They say resistance is futile. And I'm often asked what kind of resistance we got to changing the menu at Forest Green Rovers, and then that's my answer quite often. It didn't actually matter, because it was futile. We were going to make that change anyway. But we didn't do it in an arrogant or high-handed way. We engaged with our fans. We talked to them about why we were making the change, not just what change we were making. And we said, look, come to football and try a new kind of food. The food is just the example here, because it was the really kind of the most emotional issue. You know, we said, come and try a new kind of food. It's 2 hours a fortnight, actually, a home game on average. And, you know, it's not a big deal. And if you don't like it, just bring your own food. You know, it's not like we care. But we're doing this according to our own principles, and we have to operate that way. And, you know, it didn't take very long at all for even the most ardent meat eaters, I would say, because there was a small crowd of people that were a bit angry about it. They thought they were being dictated to, and we said, that's not actually what's happening. We're just setting the menu according to our principles. But it wasn't long before they came around as well, because the bar in football food is super low. You know, you probably find it lower than a limbo bar, probably. And so the food that we made, this vegan food, was just easily far better. You know, for us, it's 10 years in the past now, in the rearview mirror, but it's still the big question everybody asks: how do you take your football club or your sporting event vegan without having a riot? And I think it's never been easier. You know, vegan food is more prevalent now. The diet, the lifestyle is more commonplace. The products are there. Everybody knows about it. You know, it's easy to do today. And everything else has just kind of flowed from that. We use energy, transport and food as our template. So we put some solar panels in, did the energy efficiency stuff, electric car charging points on the transport front. We've got electric vehicles in the pool, not yet an electric team coach, but they're coming soon. Organic pitch means no artificial pesticides and fertilizers. It's a big issue in agriculture and a big issue in the climate clusterfuck, if I can say that, or let's call it the climate crisis. And then we started looking at materials for shirts. So a couple of years ago, we launched bamboo as a new sustainable material. And this year we're launching coffee grounds, which is a bit of fun. And at the same time, we launch a new shirt every 2 years, not every year, so that our fans can keep them for longer. You know, so you got to look at the details as well as the big picture. We've taken out single-use plastics and stuff like that. And we've taken our fans on a journey. And probably the most important point for me is that our fans don't just tolerate what we've done and what we do and what we stand for. They embrace it. They're proud of it. I bump into fans all of the time that tell me they've gone veggie or vegan, they've got an electric car. One guy the other, last time we had a game with fans, actually, he was volunteering on the gate and he said to me, I've got an electric car, I'm veggie, not yet vegan, I've got solar panels and they're getting a battery for my house. And I was like, wow, I mean, that's more than I've got. I haven't got a battery for my house. And so I would say we went into this thinking football fans would be a relatively untouched, potentially difficult audience to take the message to. That made it more appealing for us. And what we found is they're not. I mean, they're just like normal people. You take them the information, you show them what's wrong and how to do something differently. We don't preach or push people. We just say, this is why we do what we do. And they pick that up and change their lives accordingly.
How important has it been that you've been successful on the pitch?
Vital, vital. The way I see it, we've got two legs. One of them is football and one is sustainability. And, you know, to have any real credibility as a sustainable football club, we've got to have credibility as a football club. And I would say there's a great symbiosis between the two, actually. You know, the sustainability agenda has got us global coverage and a global fan base now. But at the same time, it's important that we play good football and we do exciting things, get promoted, that kind of stuff. In everything that I've done in sustainability, I've come to realise that when you're offering a green alternative to something, it can't be in any way substandard. So, you know, we built a car in 2008, an electric car. You couldn't buy one in the world. And we knew right then that we had to build a great car, had to look good, had to go good, you know, had to have a high top speed, great handling, that kind of stuff. Our organic pitch, it's all well and good having one, but if the grass isn't great, if it isn't a great pitch, people will say, oh yeah, it's organic, but, and you don't want that. Same with food, you don't want yes, but. And so everything you have to do when you propose a green alternative has to be at least as good as the conventional alternative.
And is it more expensive? Like, is it more expensive to run Forest Green than it is to run, I don't know, Stevenage or Rotherham or Watford in relative terms?
I don't actually know what it takes to run those clubs. But what I know is that typically in green stuff, you swap operating expenditure for capital expenditure. So, for example, if we buy solar panels, we pay a certain price up front that you don't pay if you just buy grid electricity. But for the next 20 years, we have solar powered electricity that cuts the electricity bill. And this is true of most green measures. You do a little bit of investment in the technology. Energy efficiency is a good example. The payback period in energy efficiency would be 2 years, maybe. Solar panels is about 7 years, that kind of stuff. So you just swap one for the other. So longer term, your operating costs are lower along with your carbon footprint. That's quite normal.
Tell us about the new stadium. It's all wooden stadium, is that right?
Yeah, it is. Yes. So it's been designed for us by Zaha Hadid's practice, and it resulted from a competition we set, must be 7 or 8 years ago now. We were looking for the greenest football stadium that had ever been built, more or less, you know, so nothing too challenging. And we got an awful lot of responses. Among them was Zaha Hadid. They said they were only interested by the brief. The scale of the project wasn't really big enough for them, but we were super blessed by that because they quite easily won with an incredible design. I mean, it looks beautiful, but it's to be made entirely of wood. And the environment message in that I learned is really interesting. The carbon footprint of any sports stadia throughout its entire operating life is 75% locked in on day one because it's in the materials that it's built with, concrete and steel. So by having a wooden stadium, we're going to have the lowest carbon footprint anywhere in the world since the Romans invented concrete, I reckon.
That's a rather glib point, but presumably that will be safe. And
fireproof.
Yeah. Yes. You know, you're not allowed smoke in football stadiums anymore, but people do at halftime have a crafty one in the gents.
It won't burn down, yeah. Is the question.
Yeah, look, it's a question that comes up all of the time, of course. And there are a number of things to bear in mind. One is modern timber is engineered to be fire retardant. It's actually safer in a fire than steel because steel will collapse at a certain temperature, but the wood will just char, so you won't have the roof falling on your head. Modern stadia are designed to be emptied in a handful of minutes, which wasn't true of the old stadia where fire disasters did happen. And of course, as you say, there's no smoking anyway. And it's the cigarettes falling through the stands into the accumulated rubbish underneath that started those fires. And, you know, that won't be happening. Even if somebody does have a fag, they won't be able to drop it onto some rubbish that's been accumulating underneath. So for so many reasons, it'll be safe.
It was interesting what you said about football fans and going along with the journey, because my hunch is that football fans are not necessarily like early adopters for change, and you know they like things how they used to be. You know, you could just talk about VAR, for example, which I would love to get rid of, actually. What about other chairmen? You know, I'm sort of trying to think of it. In my mind, all League One and League Two chairmen are sort of slightly rosy-faced climate deniers, probably. And I don't know if I'm being completely unfair, but have you got the sense that people are interested when they come to Forest Green or when you go to a game that they're talking to you about sustainability and changes they can make?
Yeah, definitely. And I would say it's transitioned as well from the early days, from being like interested in something that was really quite an oddity, to more recently interested in something that they actually have a genuine interest in, and they're starting to think about what they can do as a club as well. So we've had lots of conversations with clubs in League One, League Two, and the Premier League Championship as well about what they can do. And it will be across any number of things like electric cars, or it could be food, it could be organic pitches, anything really. And everybody's got their own kind of particular interest, it seems to me. You know, whenever I'm chatting to somebody from another club, there'll be one particular part of what we've done that they're interested in.
And finally, lots of people wanted to tweet in and say, how's Hector Bellerin doing? You know, are you going to sign him, etc.? It was interesting when he sort of got involved with Forest Green.
Yeah, it was fabulous. Got in touch with us around about this time last year, I think, saying that, you know, he'd like to find a way to get involved in what he called the FGR family. And we had a chat over the summer, and then we landed on a shareholding. And, you know, he told me this lovely story about when he went vegan, how he had a conversation with his mother on the phone about it. And she was like, but Hector, you don't even like vegetables, which really made me laugh. But he's a lovely guy and, you know, really keen to be a part of the club. And I don't know where it'll go in the future, but it's just great to have him on board.
Brilliant. Well, that's fascinating part two. Part three, we will ask what needs to be done on a grand scale and on a small scale, what football fans, what we can do to make a difference. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly, a special on the climate crisis and its relationship with football, with the author David Goldblatt, podcaster Ollie Hayes, owner of Forest Green Rovers, Dale Vince. You mentioned, David, the UN Sport for Climate Action framework. Liverpool, Spurs, Southampton, Arsenal have signed up to that. What is it?
Well, it's pretty lowest common denominator of what can be agreed amongst the major sports federations and big commercial operations. And at the moment, it commits people to being climate neutral by 2050. So getting carbon zero by 2050 and encouraging their fans, their members, their constituents, whatever kind of organisation they are, to embrace that same agenda, to speak to their sponsors, etc. None of this is kind of fixed. There's no kind of compulsion. It's everybody's joining up. And on the one hand, that's great. You know, it's the beginning. But the real problem, A, there's no issue about sponsorship. And that was a really good point that that was made earlier. I mean, if we're going down this path, we can't be taking money from Gazprom or SOCAR, you know, the Azerbaijani national oil company, Atletico Madrid. I think there's a debate over vehicles because, you know, we're going to have to replace pretty much every single vehicle on this planet in the next 30 years and someone's got to build them. So it depends what kind of vehicle maker you are. And the other problem is that, you know, sport, if football in particular is going to make a difference, we're going to make a difference not by being last and not by being carbon neutral in 2050, but by doing it now, by being the catalyst, by showing the way. And so we really, you know, the UN and the signatories, everybody needs to up their game and commit to being carbon zero for 2030. Because that's, you know, we need to make those big changes to prevent the worst of the more than 2 degrees centigrade rise. We need to make big changes in the next 10 years. And as Dale says, it's not rocket science. Change your energy forms of, you know, where you buy your energy, change your food offering, change the materials you're using, and this is the tricky one, a massive investment in public transport, walking and cycling for people going to sports events of all kinds. And this is, you know, this is not just, football can't do it by itself, of course. I mean, let's take the case of Bristol Rovers, who would like to have as many people as possible cycling and taking the bus to the stadium. But at the moment, 82% of people go to the stadium by car. And the reason that they do is that the bus service in Bristol requires most of the fan base who live in East Bristol to get a bus into town and then another one back out again, because they don't do cross-city buses. And it's incredibly expensive. So, of course, people are not going to take the bus. You know, this is about structural change at a kind of governmental level, at a high level. It's about structural change at the club level. And then it's about the contribution we can all make by shifting and changing some of our behaviours.
Wally, what do you think are the most important things?
Yeah, I don't disagree with anything David just said there. I think they're all the most important things. And I was thinking about when I was growing up and I had a season ticket at Cambridge when they could get them for 40 quid for under 16, so it was brilliant. But I had a Saturday job in a pub, and then I had to get the bus to the ground, and it was one bus an hour. And I would say maybe two or three times out of five, it didn't come. It didn't come. And so I'd go pleading home to my mum. It was the most pathetic experience ever. I was like, please, can you drive me into the ground? But that's the reality. Like, football isn't living in a vacuum. That what football has to do on climate change is in so many ways just what needs to happen in society. We need brilliant public transport. We need cheap, reliable public transport that's got to be clean as well. Like, we can't just expect clubs and grounds to sort of have this weirdly separate approach to the problem. And I also agree with David 100% that, like, football needs to lead. Like, this would be a brilliant thing for football to get out in front of, you know, not to be reacting to the rest of society and not to sort of be, you know, dragging its feet and trying to catch up. Like, get out there and lead, because, to be honest, politicians, the UN, political parties, they're nowhere near where we need to be. So, you know, setting targets according to what's been agreed at the Paris Climate Summit 5 years ago, that's not enough. Like, we need to go faster and further. And talking about 2050 is too far away. What matters is what happens in the next 5-10 years. So, yeah, I think football getting out ahead and trying to own this issue and make it like a real badge of honour would be amazing.
Dale?
Yeah, I don't think the UN are out of touch. I don't think they're talking about 2050. They're talking about 10 years to save the planet. That's science driven. As David says, we've got to follow the science. The pandemic taught us that. I thought David said he'd dropped cynicism 30 years ago, or after 30 years of it, but he led with some great cynicism about the UN Support for Climate Action Programme, which I found a little bit disappointing, only because it's such a great initiative and it's kind of, you know, brand new, and the UN are making a difference here. And it's not just about getting sports clubs to sort themselves out. It's about reaching their fan base with that information. Because the thing we haven't talked about on this podcast yet today is the platform that football and sport has, the ability it has to influence the lives of ordinary people. And as was just said, football doesn't live in a bubble. Public transport is an issue for the whole of our world, really. The other important part of that bubble that we don't live in is the general population, and we have to get them to understand what the issues are, what the changes are that they can make, and make it accessible for them. And that's what this UN Support for Climate Action Programme is about, and I think it's a good thing. And I think it's easy to point at football and say you're being a bit slow and, you know, you should be leading and stuff like that. And, you know, I go along with it. But I don't think football is particularly behind the curve. If you look at our world, society, industry, businesses, that kind of stuff, you know, I think it's somewhere in the middle, not at the front, not at the back. But it has a massive role that it could play, because billions of people are sports fans. And if we can reach them through the medium of sport, we can get them to change their lives. We found that at Forest Green. So I'm just massively positive about the whole thing. I think the UN are in the right place on this, as they are with the global climate targets.
David, how has Dale's answer just then affected your cynicism-ometer?
I'm not cynical at all about the UN framework. I think it's a fabulous thing, and I've written on a number of occasions and spoken to that effect. I do think it still is, for the most part, looking at 2050. It isn't addressing the sponsorship issue yet. There are weaknesses in it. I'm not against it. I think it's a good thing. Every single sporting organisation in the world should sign up. It should be stricter. And I do think if football is, and sport is to have that catalytic effect, then it has to really be pushing the envelope. And that means, you know, trying to be carbon zero by 2030, addressing your spectator numbers. So I'm not against, I'm with Dale. I just want to encourage people to be more ambitious. And I think, you know, football in particular is a rare place where people experience the emotional kind of reality of last minute turnarounds. Because that's what we're looking here. I mean, forgive the cliche, but like, we're seriously in extra time, folks. Like, and there's not going to be much injury time either, and the bench isn't great. You know, we need to believe that actually sudden, large-scale change is possible. And people struggle with that. And we all struggle with that. And football is a place where you actually experience it. I mean, did you watch the second semi-final, Ajax-Tottenham in 2019?
Oh, yeah. I was dancing around the room with my big team who win things, yeah.
I mean, that's... And, you know, it is slightly corny, but it's a rare place people really do experience something profound about the possibility of change, about the possibility of collective endeavour, you know, because sport, like dealing with climate change, football, it's a team game. We've got to do this together.
We've got to rely on Lucas Moura to save us all. Barry, you wanted to come in.
Well, I was just going to say, football fans don't mind change, I think, as long as it benefits them in a positive way. But looking at this, you know, I can foresee a problem where fans will mull over what's been said and go, well, if I get on board with this, there will be possibly less games. I will be discouraged from travelling to watch my team play away from home or in Europe. And those are things, sacrifices I'm not prepared to make.
I mean, I think it's a really good point, Barry. And it's not just about football fans. This is like everybody's facing those kind of consumption choices. Those of us who are lucky enough to have enough wealth to make those choices. Yeah, that's coming down the line. It may be, I don't think that's where we need to start. I think we can start by saying, okay, we need better public transport. We need to offset the carbon costs of the travel that we do have, a la UEFA or Qatar 2022. And maybe 5 or 10 years down the line, we'll see what the climate crisis looks like. Maybe there won't be room for us all for that level of mass transportation. You know, maybe. We don't know yet. So I don't think we have to jump to conclusions, but I think they are difficult conversations. It may not be possible 20, 30 years down the line, but we have to start somewhere, and we can start with the easy. There's a lot of easy stuff to do, as Dale said. You know, 70% of it could be dealt with it, certainly by big Premier League clubs, just like that.
Yeah, starting somewhere is a point I wanted to make, actually, in response to what David said before. You know, the kind of, let's call it mild criticism of the UN programme. Lowest common denominator, I think, is one way that he did describe it. But to say that it doesn't go far enough, it's not tough enough and that kind of stuff. And I get that. But I was also in the room when this was being formed, and the view was very much that it had to be accessible, not put off sports organisations. If it looked too tough, then people wouldn't join. Getting them to join is the first important step, and then getting them to do something can follow that. And I think it's the same with the public as well. You know, if we make this look like an impossible journey or transformation that they have to make of their lifestyles, it puts people off. You know, it's like veganism, you know, is a term that used to sound like some kind of crazy cult. And the idea that you have to give up everything from animals on day one puts a lot of people off. But I don't take that approach myself. I think it's important just to get going, you know, start down the road, miss out a few meals with meat in, miss out a few days. And before you know it, you know, you're on your way. I think the really important thing is to just get started, because too often people are put off by the absolutism that you can often find on social media, for example, the kind of yes, but what about this and what about that? And the stuff that we can't deal with today, we shouldn't sweat, like flying, because 10 years from now, there'll be electric planes in the sky. And we'll look differently at international football competitions because fans will be able to get there with a zero carbon footprint. That's changing in the background.
Yeah, we live in a high carbon extractive society, economy, world. Like we can't pretend that we don't. So everything we do in our daily lives is, at the moment, is often, you know, quite high carbon. And obviously there's a spectrum, there's things you can do, and as David said, if you've got the luxury of choice and a bit of cash, you can probably do more things at the moment. But let's not forget that, like, what needs to change is kind of everything, and only once that systemic change has happened can we actually start to make choices which are easier and a lot greener? And that systemic change has to happen when the people in power make decisions that they might find uncomfortable, but they've got to take responsibility for. And that's, I think, what I find a little bit frustrating with, it's not just the football climate debate, but the climate debate more broadly, is that these, you know, BP famously started it with a kind of, they invented the idea of the personal carbon footprint. They got everyone talking about what we can do and bringing kind of personal morality into it. You know, oh, am I driving too much? Am I eating too much meat? And it's like, you're BP. You know, don't tell us what to do. And it's just, you know, we've got a similar sort of thing here. We need these clubs who are fantastically rich, institutions, FIFA and all the rest of it, raking in cash. They're the people with power. They've got to lead from the front before we start feeling too guilty about or, you know, troubled by the choices that we've got to make.
Can I ask you a question, Dan, about regionalising Leagues 1 and 2 to cut down travel?
You mean as in would I be in favour of
yeah.
it? No, I wouldn't actually. And I think, you know, I'd refer back to at least some of David's statistics around the carbon content of travel as an example of why I don't think it's an important thing to do or a valuable thing to do. I think we'd lose more than we gained that way by regionalising Leagues 1 and 2.
Tim Walters wrote a piece in The Blizzard where he suggested that pretty much the only piece I could find about sort of climate change in football, one of the only ones, it suggested the scheduling mayhem caused by the pandemic gives us an opportunity to like reimagine the football calendar. He tweeted us to say, I'm excited you're having this conversation. I'm hopeful you'll discuss the idea of playing much less football, because even if the game does absolutely everything else right, there's no way it can get to where it needs to be otherwise. I know, Barry, you'd love there to be just a bit less football. Anyway, it's interesting you talking about, you know, making the changes sort of acceptable to fans. I think a lot of fans would find that hard. I don't know. But does Tim make a good point there, David?
Depends what he means by less football. And again, it all depends.
Well, sorry, one of the ideas he mooted was playing the season over 2 years, basically. So,
okay. I mean, guys, one thing asking people to take the bus, it's another thing to ask them to expect a season over 2 years. That's going to be a very difficult sell. I think there probably is a bit too much football in the commercial world myself. I mean, I could live without, and I say this, you know, as a part-time Spurs fan, the Lee Caribou Cup, no problem. If that disappeared off the calendar, that
at really least let Spurs
so
play the final,
would not
baby.
Be a problem. Well, exactly, and I can watch them lose another one, yeah. Like I did the last time, right? So we could just, you know, cut out the middleman and just get rid of the tournament altogether. I think further down the line, this is a conversation we may have to have about how much there is. But I think because the overwhelming amount of carbon is generated by people going to the stadium, that's not away fans, it's not the travel of teams. You know, if we had a decent public transport system in this country and, you know, Copenhagen level of kind of cycling and walking, it just wouldn't be a problem we were playing more football, because we wouldn't be producing such an enormous amount of carbon every time if we weren't eating loads of, right, slightly dodgy meat in pies at football, you know, and we were eating really delicious hummus and falafel wraps. It wouldn't be a problem if we were playing more football. So it's not the amount of football, it's the amount of carbon per game being burnt that seems to me the issue.
Finally, can I ask what should people listening to this who love football, who either go or watch in the pub when we're allowed in or watch on TV, like what should they be doing? I'll start with you, Ollie.
They should support Cambridge United, definitely. That's step one. You know, there's been some amazing, amazing examples recently of football and footballers leading the charge on social change. Like, look at Megan Rapinoe, look at Marcus Rashford. And I think that should just kind of give us all hope that this is an incredibly powerful sport, an incredibly powerful actor in society and in culture. And so, like, pushing our clubs and pushing our teams, or not even pushing, just gently asking, you know, what is it you're doing? And, like, we want you to do this stuff. You know, we want a habitable planet. We want a brilliant public transport system. We want to be able to keep coming to watch the games and getting everything that we get from them. You know, what are you doing to help us do that in a kind of climate-friendly way? I think just asking the question is is a great start. I think there's a lot to be said. We've talked about this on our podcast on Sustainable. There's a lot to be said for the social cohesion that comes from just going to a match and like finding your tribe and finding groups of people who are not the same as you, because we're all sat in our social bubbles and ever narrowing social bubbles. And I think football's one of those rare occasions where you're mixing with people who aren't all the same as you and have different opinions, but you're all unified around this kind of desperation for your team to stick it in the back of the net. So yeah, it's brilliant. Just keep going to football, keep embracing the joy and meaning that it brings to our lives, and because we're going to need a lot of that in the coming decades.
And the pain it brings to your lives as well.
And the pain. Yeah, I'm getting a bit drunk on this season, to be honest, with Cambridge. I'm forgetting all the other seasons.
I can't do it. Honestly, I'd rather be 11th. I find the pain of it, I find the stress of it too much. Dale, what would you recommend to people?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to agree with there, Wally said. I think primarily I would say to sports fans, football fans, get in touch with your club and let them know what it is you want. I mean, lobby for changes in the menu. You know, let's get more vegan stuff on the menu. We've seen this work. Fans of other clubs have come to Forest Green, gone back home, lobbied their own clubs, and they've put on vegan options. Some kind of grassroots fan power, you know, I think. And if clubs feel that from the bottom and they also see from the top that they need to compete with other clubs because they're adopting these measures, then that's the perfect sandwich for them to be in.
David?
Well, the first thing, if I'm allowed a bit of advertising, is that I am the chair of trustees of a newly formed NGO called Football for Future. And you can find footballforfuture.org on the internet and also on Instagram and all the usual places. So go and take a look at that website. It's hoping to be the kick it out of sustainability in British football. Plenty of information. Educate oneself. I think the second thing I'd just say to everyone is, certainly from where I'm coming from, and I think it sort of ties to Dale's idea that, you know, the green alternative needs to be at least as good, if not better, of what we had, is, you know, this debate is not about trying to punish people. It's about trying to secure the future of something that we love. You know, for me, you know, the definition of the good life definitely includes being able to go and see and support Bristol Rovers, right? But if we want that, you know, if we are the custodians of this sport, we want this to be around in 20, 30 years, we have to make a contribution now. It's not about punishment. It's about preserving something beautiful for the future. And yes, even Bristol Rovers can be beautiful.
And Ollie, you said probably the greenest football of all is just having a kickabout with your mates in the park.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we're always kind of wondering whether is it greenest to recycle or drive an electric car or whatever. But I can't think of many things greener than just going and having a kick around. Like, it's what a brilliant kind of bit of low carbon fun and what a normal thing to do. And I think that's really important to remember, that lots of kind of really normal fun stuff is green. You don't just have to kind of badge it as green. And that's, I guess that's another reason why we need investment in the grassroots, and we need our parks to be well maintained. We need running tracks and outdoor gyms and all of that properly financed and protected, because that's a really kind of low carbon way to live and to have fun.
When I'm chatting to my teammates before the game, I think our first game back is April the 3rd away at Civil Service. And just in the huddle, you know, instead of "they don't fucking want it," I'll say, "it's time for some low carbon fun, lads."
Brilliant. The height of motivational speaking.
Bit of low carbon chat.
Listen, thank you so much for coming on. I think it's been really good. I'd love to do it again in, you know, in a few months or a year's time, just to come back and find out how far we've got. If you'd all do that, that would be brilliant. But for the time being, Dale, thanks for your time.
Yeah, pleasure. It was great fun.
Thank you, David.
Yeah, thank you so much for doing this. Really, really brilliant that you've done it. Thank you.
No worries. And cheers, Ollie.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, ditto. Brilliant that it's happening.
As always, Barry, thanks for being here.
Yes, I was a huge help.
You know, you always are, Barry. You know that. We'll be back on Friday after all the internationals.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.